Have you seen enough versions of the simple harmonic oscillator? Do you want something new? Okay, cool. So today I thought, rather than work more stuff out on the blackboard, I would give you a little bit of a feel for some interesting problem that we are trying to solve in this field. So don't be surprised if you don't understand everything that's going to be in the slides. But it's more like a real research talk. But on the other hand, I hope you get some flavor of at least one of the problems that we're working on. So to put everything into context after this whole week, here is a graph that I like, which shows you the history of the universe that we live in. So on the x-axis, we have time. And alternatively, we have energy scale. So we are here now, 14 giga years. And as you go back in time, as you can see, we are probing greater and greater and greater energy scales. So nuclear synthesis happened here. This is about 1 MeV. This is about 100 times TeV. So it's 100 times the energy of the LHC, for example. And we think that the primordial fluctuations that you've been learning about this week were generated somewhere back here at about 10 to the 15 GeV, okay? By a physical process that we haven't identified for sure, but that we have some ideas about, mainly by studying the fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. So on the y-axis, I have the fractional energy density of the universe. In a flat universe, and how that changes with time, okay? And what I like about this graph is that it's color-coded by our understanding of the physics of those components. So white means we understand it very well, and in the particle physics course, that's what you're learning about, the standard model of cosmology. You can see it's about 4% of the present energy density of the universe. There's dark matter and dark energy. We have some ideas about dark matter, basically through extensions of the standard model of particle physics. Dark energy, basically, nobody has a clue. If they tell you they understand it, I don't know what to say. So also, when you go further and further back in time, our level of understanding, again, diminishes. And in this talk, I want to try and give you some hints about how we might be able to learn about that energy range through observations of the cosmic microwave background. And let me also emphasize that it's not something that we would ever be able to learn about through accelerators, because as I said, the successor to the LHC is about 100 TeV here. This is 10 to the 15 GeV. So Lambda CDM is so-called the standard model of cosmology. It's nowhere as rigorous as the standard model of particle physics that you've been learning about. But in the past 10 years, there has been a tremendous advance in measuring the parameters of this model. Okay? So basically, that means the contents of the universe, which is describing the homogeneous background of the FRW expansion. And that's stuff like how much atoms or cold dark matter or dark energy that there is. And these things have now been measured to about percent precision. Okay? And that's a tremendous advance. For example, just 20 years ago or something, we didn't know the value of that parameter to a factor of 2. And now it's been known to percent precision. So on top of this homogeneous background, there are the perturbations. Here, there's a snapshot of those perturbations in the cosmic microwave background at about 300,000 years after the initial time. And we are making progress in characterizing the statistical properties of these fluctuations. We know their amplitude. It's about 1 part in 10 to the 5. We know the shape of their power spectrum, or we're starting to know it. And this is a parameter that will become very important later in the talk, which I won't go into now. So we have made quite a lot of progress in the last 10 years in measuring these parameters. How much of stuff is there? What's it doing? How is it expanding? However, even the name of the model, Lambda CDM, contains a bunch of unknowns. We don't know what is lambda, which is a substitute for the cosmological constant. We don't know what is the cold dark matter. That's not something I'm going to focus on here. I'm going to focus on this question here. What is the origin of all the fluctuations in the universe that grew into all the structures in the universe that we see in the universe today? Okay, so let me give you a little bit of a history about the CMB temperature measurements. The temperature of the CMB is about 3 Kelvin. And as I mentioned in the first talk, unless a very, very, very fine resolution to see these fluctuations, all you see is this uniform cosmic microwave background. It was first detected in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson, who initially thought that it was pigeon droppings in their antenna. But it turned out to be a signal from the early universe. The fluctuations in this background were first detected by the COBE satellite in 1992. And of course, these are Nobel Prize winning observations. What happened in this decade was a tremendous advance over COBE by a satellite called WMAP. And almost all of the results that I'm going to present have come from WMAP. And what it did was to map these fluctuations at a greater number of frequencies and at finer resolution. And also, there was, in the meantime, between these two, a lot of advances from the ground and from balloons in measuring the CMB as well. So when now I want to give you a little bit of a flavor of what happens when you do this measurement. You get this map, what do you do with it? So first of all, especially in an experiment with fine resolution, such as WMAP or its successors, you get a map with millions of pixels. That's a lot of data, but it can be compressed to study the information content in it. So as you've seen before, we can express the sky in a particular given direction, the temperature fluctuation, in terms of this spherical harmonic expansion. And if this anisotropy is a Gaussian random field, the real and imaginary parts of these ALMs are independent normal deviates, and they're not correlated on the full sky, because this is a complete orthogonal basis. So all the statistical information in that case is contained in the angular power spectrum, which, as you've seen before, is defined here. Okay, so we get maps, and you form this combination in terms of the ALMs. Then what we need is a likelihood function to compare a given model, which makes a prediction for these C sub Ls, with the sky. Okay? And that looks like this. It's a very simplified version of a likelihood function that we use in the CMB field. So the 2L plus 1 should be familiar, because each L mode has 2L plus 1 M modes in it. And there's this logarithmic part, and there is this part as well. And you can see that there's a theory, CL. There's a noise, CL, that is the detector noise. Remember when you were doing that numerical experiment, the error bars were blowing up at very small scales. Do you remember that? Yeah, so that's because of this factor here. And this is an estimator for the sky CLs, okay? So this is what we see, and this is our model for it. This is the underlying theory power spectrum, and this is the experiment noise, okay? And you can see that at very large scales, this logarithmic term dominates, okay? And so that is slightly contrary to expectations if you're used to systems where the noise is Gaussian, okay? So it's more likely to scatter low than to scatter high from the theory power spectrum when you actually make an observation, because it's this logarithmic term. And then there's this Gaussian term, this might not look very Gaussian to you, but remember that these CLs are formed of ALN squared, okay? So this term dominates at small scales. That's because when you have enough L modes, by the central limit theorem, you approach a Gaussian. So we also see that there's cosmic variance, because even when there's no noise term for an ideal experiment, you can only measure these 2L plus 1 modes. So what we're talking about here is a radical data compression. First of all, what the experiment is doing is that it's looking at that part of the sky and that part of the sky, taking temperature differences. And that's a data point. And then it does that as a function of time while scanning the sky. And then it sends down that data as a number of data points. And for the WMAP experiment, after 5 years, that's about 100 gigabytes. I mean, it's not that many movies, but that's a hell of a lot of data points looking at different parts of the sky. Okay? And then using this information and information about where the satellite was in its orbit and where it was pointing at any given time, you can compress this 100 gigabytes into about 50 million pixels and form a map. Okay? So that's already a dramatic compression of data. And then using the statistical process that I described before, from the map you can obtain the CLs, right? And then get the angular power spectrum. So you've turned the millions of pixels into about 1,000 numbers in the angular power spectrum, right? And then characterizing the likelihood function and the model parameters, so both the experimental statistics and the physics, you turn the angular power spectrum into a model which has about 10 parameters, which is your cosmological model, okay? So is that clear what's going on in this kind of cartoon process of analyzing an experiment like that? So here's the WMAP temperature power spectrum. So that's after getting to this step. And you guys downloaded this data and plotted it, right? Remember that? Unfortunately, for some reason, this thing is taking away the cosmic variance. How nice if we could do that in the real universe. So there's a gray band here showing the cosmic variance. I'm afraid it's disappeared. However, what you see here is binned multiples. Like you remember, some of you were plotting the binned data in L. And then the black point actually has an error bar on it. It's an instrumental noise, and it's so small that you can't even see it. But as you go to smaller scales, see, this is angular scale, this is multiple, so you can see we're going to smaller scales this way. We see that the error bar is blowing up. That's the experimental noise. If you could see this gray band, you would see it's very large here, becomes smaller there, a bit bigger here, and then it basically vanishes, okay? So that's at large scales, that's what the spectrum looks like. The situation, you saw in WMAP, the error bar was blowing up here. There are ground-based experiments that observe the smaller patches of the sky that are much higher resolution, and some of them are listed here. And they have gone and tried to measure this so-called damping tail. Remember the damping tail due to photon diffusion? So that's still the first peak. So the black dots are WMAP. And then this is additional data from ground-based experiments. So this is the current state of the art with a lambda CDM model there put to guide the eye. But you can see it's a pretty good fit even by eye. I hope you can see that. So what have we learned from having measured this? We have seen that there's this Saxe-Wolf plateau at large scales, where it goes kind of flat. So those are essentially unprocessed primordial fluctuations. And we see that there's the integrated Saxe-Wolf effect from the decay of potentials in the late time universe due to dark energy domination, yes. Because its resolution is much worse than these experiments. So this is the third peak, right? So that's basically where its noise blows up. And the reason its noise blows up is a combination of the detector sensitivity and the resolution, OK? And these experiments have much finer resolution, actually higher sensitivity, because they need to also go down in amplitude, you see? Because can you guess why? Can you see the whole sky from one location on the Earth? You need to see the full sky in order to get the very largest modes, right? Because the largest mode is L equals 2. L equals 2 is a mode that spans the full sky. Yeah? Is that clear? Is there a question back there? OK. Right. OK, so that's the reason for that. So polarization experiments are also ongoing. WMAP is polarization sensitive, but it's a new field. And you'll see why soon, because this signal is actually way down from the temperature signal. Remember, the polarization signal comes from the fact that electrons see the temperature quadrupole. Remember, the temperature quadrupole is a second order effect that comes from the breakdown of the tight coupling approximation. So it's not even there if you do a zeroth order calculation. And you saw yourself, just with differential equations, how far you could get with that assumption and describe the peak structure. So this is a much smaller effect than the temperature. So these bars here are expected to be a fairly, you know, our best guess as to what the polarization looks like at those kind of angular scales. But this is a much, much, much worse picture than the fidelity to which we know these underlying patches in the temperature. And it was first detected by a DAISY experiment in 2002, and this is a ground-based experiment. After that, progress has been made, and compared to that, the beautiful curve in the previous plot, you can see a bunch of ratty error bars. So this is the temperature polarization cross power spectrum. And it, remember, temperature is correlated with the polarization because it's the temperature quadrupole that sources the polarization. So you can see that there is, at least here, there's a hint of a peak, right? Here, maybe, I don't know, right? And so there's the temperature polarization power spectrum. This is the polarization order power spectrum. And again, there's a hint of a structure of peaks. But look at, this is supposed to be, sorry, it's cut off. It's supposed to be, again, microkelvin squared. So remember, the temperature was at about 5,000, the first peak, right? This is 100, order of magnitude down. It's another order of magnitude down to see this one. And then there's this BB, which is going to be the focus of most of this talk. It has not been detected. And as you can see here, the upper limits here are the same level as the detections there. And that's because that's the sensitivity of the experiment, right? So we will talk much more about this one. So what we have seen here is that the polarization forms a cross-check of the temperature prediction for where these peaks and troughs should be. Hopefully you have a vague memory of me saying that the peaks of the dipole are pi over 2 out of phase with the peaks of the monopole. Do you remember that? So that forms a prediction to where these peaks and troughs should be, and it actually is satisfied by these observations. Let's move on to where it's going from here. Where it's going from here, I'm wearing my Planck shirt today. So Planck is the next generation spacecraft, which is currently at L2. L2 is the Lagrange point of the Earth-Moon system. It's way out there, way beyond the, sorry, it's the Earth-Sun system. So it's way beyond the orbit of the Moon. And so that's COBE. COBE had a beam as in point spread function of 7 degrees. and this map has been degraded to show the level of detail it could see on the sky. And COBE was the one that first detected these fluctuations. This is WMAP. It has a beam of 15 arc minutes. OK. Let's just quickly go back to this plot, which had a scale on it. So this is 0.2 degrees here, right? It has, do you know, maybe you don't know. Do you know what arc minutes are? OK. So in a degree, there are 60 arc minutes. OK? So it's an angular scale. Oops. Right. So that's WMAP. And this is the highest resolution frequency band of WMAP. So you can see it's much more sensitive to smaller scale fluctuations than COBE. And this is Planck. So you can see it's a factor of 5 better in resolution. A factor of 3 better in resolution. And it also has much greater frequency coverage, which will become clear why that's important. And it's also polarization sensitive, and its sensitivity is much higher. So this should extract all the available information in the primary CMB power spectrum. Okay. And it should also make a big advance in polarization measurements. So once it does that, so it started mapping the sky in August. And after 2 weeks, the power spectrum was better than 5 years of WMAP. It's amazing. It's working very well. And people are extremely pleased. So after this, what can we say? Have we got all the information out of the CMB? I'm going to tell you about one problem for which, it's very physically interesting and for which Planck actually probably won't help that much. Okay? So there are two frontiers following from Planck that you could use to study something about our universe. The first is called secondary anisotropies. And I put this slide here to remind you that things happen to these CMB photons on the way from the last scattering surface to us. The first thing is that the first stars turn on, and they reionize the universe with their radiation. And so that sources polarization as well. The other thing that happens is that as the universe evolves, structure forms, and the photons are passing through these massive structures and being lensed. So there's a weak lensing signal that gets added onto the CMB. It also passes through very hot, large clumps of gas in clusters. And of course, the moment you see free electrons around, you scatter the CMB photons again. So all of these things can be used as probes of the growth of structure. And there are experiments right now at the South Pole and also in Chile studying these kinds of things. What I'm going to talk about is the other next frontier, which is to measure the polarization much better. Because you must have seen that the polarization constraints at the present are much worse than the temperature ones. But if all polarization provides is essentially a cross-check of the temperature, why is that important? So that's only true of the EE power spectrum. The B mode power spectrum is sensitive, as I mentioned on the first day, to tensor modes, right? So that's what we need in order to answer what was the source of the first fluctuations in the universe. So hopefully you did this calculation on the first day. You took the coastal horizon at recombination, and you projected it onto our sky. And you found that it projected to a size of 1 degree. You remember that? OK. Stunned silence. OK. I hope you did that, and you found that the coastal size of the horizon at last scattering was 1 degree. We know that the temperature is correlated over much larger areas than 1 degree, right? You just look up at the sky and you see this. This is one part in one, you know, 100,000 fluctuations here. And this is a massive problem. I mean, how does the temperature know that it can only be different from this one at one part in 100,000? So just anticipating the greater detail that you will get about this issue in your next week's lectures, the horizon problem can be described as follows. So here's, say, the WMAP experiment. It's viewing the last scattering surface. This is its past light cone. So all the light from within this past light cone could have reached it, right? In an exaggerated way, this is the horizon of the Big Bang cosmology. You know, so at some initial time, it's expanding, it's becoming larger. Things within, at this time, things that are within this cone are causally connected, right? You can see that the past light cone in the Big Bang cosmology seen by, say, WMAP is much wider than the horizon size. So how does the temperature fluctuation here know to correlate to one part in 100,000 with the one there? This is called the horizon problem. So inflation is a way to solve the horizon problem by changing the causal structure of space-time. And this is one way of visualizing it. So on the x-axis, we have time after the initial time. And on the y-axis, we essentially have the scale factor, the factor by which the universe has expanded since initial time. In the standard Big Bang expansion, it's basically like that. So at this very early time, this is 10 to the minus 35 seconds, okay? It was that size, right? What inflation does is to introduce a rapid growth spurt, almost exponential expansion, at this very early time, so that in a tiny instant, it expanded by a factor of about 10 to the 30. So the initial size of the universe before that is significantly smaller than you thought it was, and that explains why the horizon problem can be solved. To show it in another way, that's the same plot as before. There's space and time again. That's the previous plot. What inflation does is to make the initial horizon blow up very rapidly in a very small amount of time, so that actually the true horizon is much larger than we thought it was if we were only Big Bang cosmologists. Yet another way of seeing that is in terms of the co-moving Hubble radius. Okay, so here now we have the scale factor on the x-axis. It's set to 1 now, and you can see how it evolves earlier in time. And this is how to connect the scale factor to a co-moving physical distance in the universe. Okay, so the co-moving Hubble radius is written here. So this curve shows that if it's, you know, if it's below this line, you're causally connected. If you're above this line, you're not causally connected, right? So remember, these are physical scales. So this band represents cosmological scales, the scales that are of interest to cosmology. So everything that's smaller than that, like this room, would be, I don't know, somewhere down here, okay? So this is what we observe. And if it's red, it means it was causally connected, right? So if this part wasn't here, so this is the horizon during inflation, all you have is this. This is matter domination, radiation domination forever, yeah? Right, so can you see that if you have a physical scale of that size, and that part of the plot wasn't there, it was never causally connected, right? It's always outside the horizon, then it comes back in. We have no explanation for why the temperature is the same for all of those scales, right? But inflation changes this so that at very early times, it comes back within the horizon. So at some point, this scale exited the horizon. It evolved outside the horizon, essentially remaining constant. And at some late time, she's now coming back inside the horizon. Okay? So it leaves and then comes back in. Yes?
The horizon size blowing up towards infinity as you approach the Big Bang?
Sorry?
Just like, I'm having trouble reading the scales. I'm wondering if, like, if you rescaled it so both the scales were, like, just linear, would it show the horizon blowing up to infinity as you approach the Big Bang? Like,
So the Hubble horizon is the Hubble horizon is roughly constant during inflation.
Okay.
The Kolmogorov horizon looks like it's blowing up, but inflation is of finite duration. It doesn't go on forever, hopefully. Because if it did, then if inflation didn't end, we wouldn't be here. We'd still be inflating. Well, actually, the universe has just started inflating, hasn't it? Because dark energy, that's what it's doing. It's causing the universe to expand almost exponentially. Accelerate in its expansion. So inflation is also accelerating expansion. The energy scales, of course, are extremely different. So this is the metric that describes this process, right? So you can see the scale factor is exponential, but the Hubble can't call it a Hubble constant. In this particular case, it is actually a Hubble constant, right? It's constant during inflation. And it solves the horizon problem, the flatness problem, and the monopole problem, which you will get in gory detail, I believe, on Monday. But that basically means that it explains why it's so large, so flat, and so empty. It predicts the scalar fluctuations in the CMB temperature, and it predicts that they're nearly scale invariant and approximately Gaussian, and this approximately is a very good approximately. And also, it may predict primordial tensor fluctuations or gravitational waves. And this one, whether we can see this or not, depends on the energy scale of inflation. Again, this will be gone through carefully next week, but it's usually implemented as a slowly rolling scalar field evolving in a potential. And the expansion rate given here is just the Friedmann equation, right? And this is a phi dot squared. This is just a kinetic term. And this is the potential term. And the condition for accelerated expansion, as you will see, is that the potential dominates over the kinetic term. And then when you write down the pressure of the scalar field and divide it by the density and get the equation state, you'll see that it's minus 1. So to a good approximation. So the evolution equation for this scalar field phi is given here. That should also look quite familiar to you after this week of simple harmonic oscillator business. That's, again, a friction term there. So what happens is that inflation goes on where it's rolling on almost flat potential. And eventually, inflation ends, and the standard Big Bang expansion begins. And all the energy density that was in the scalar field gets converted to the particles and fields of the standard model, okay? And the fluctuations, where did they come from? So they arise from quantum fluctuations and evolve classically. So I like this. I think it's some kind of ad for a TV or something. So it shows lots of balls rolling down hills in San Francisco. But what I like about it is that the balls, which supposedly represent the inflaton, have all these stochastic fluctuations at all different wave numbers. That's kind of what's going on. So there are quantum fluctuations of this scalar field, and they eventually, the wave number goes outside the horizon and then evolves classically. I'll just pass this by you as a statement rather than a derivation. But the energy density, the power spectrum of the scalar field is related to the Hubble parameter during inflation squared, right? And when you convert a fluctuation in the scalar field into a fluctuation in the density, you get this expression, right? It's related to the dynamics during inflation. So the H appears here. This is the velocity of the scalar field. And not only that, it generates, lo and behold, a tensor mode, right? So all this week, we've been talking about scalar modes, the evolution of density fluctuations. However, This process, which we say could have sourced these fluctuations, also generates a tensor mode, right? And this tensor mode is also related to this expansion rate. So it's the same H that appears here and here and here. So it's not some, you know, it's not like, oh, there's a tensor mode, we don't know what it looks like. Once you specify this H, you should be able to calculate it. And if you see this and you see this, you should see a consistency between them given by these expressions. However, the problem is that we don't know what is H. Or actually, the problem is that we know too much what H is, because every single theorist out there has their favorite version of what H looks like. So we don't actually know the dynamics of inflation. We have too many predictions. So what we try to do is to look at the observations, and we see how these things scale, right? And this is the scalar and tensor power spectra. And then we try to say, OK, if it looks like this, what age did it imply happened in the early universe? And in this way, we try to see whether we can infer the dynamics from observations and see what theories are consistent with that. So the ratio between the tensor mode and the scalar mode is called the tensor to scalar ratio, boringly enough. And it's just the ratio between the power spectra at some k. Okay? So that, that is a basic summary of inflation, which you will get in greater detail next week. There's actually a lot of evidence that this process happened, or something like this process happened in the early universe. First of all, we see that there are fluctuations at super horizon scales. You can see that just by looking at the CMB map. But you can see it more rigorously as well. The other thing that you might remember is that when we solved for the simple harmonic oscillator, all we got left with was a cosine mode. And it had that theta 0 in front. If that theta 0 was not there, you would not get a cosine mode, right? The only other option was having a sine mode, right? Sine mode makes a different prediction for the shape of the CMB oscillations, because you know it's out of phase with the cosine mode. But what we think we observe at very high significance is a cosine mode, right? So this means that the initial fluctuations had to be there in some acausal process. So there's already evidence for that. Inflation predicts that the universe is flat. You will do the flatness problem next week and see that the observed flatness of the universe is extremely unlikely. But inflation provides a dynamical way of getting the geometry of the universe to be flat. And that has been tested to about 1%. The Gaussianity prediction, because quantum fluctuations, of course, they're Gaussian. They're also the simple harmonic oscillator, yet again. So the fluctuations from inflation are Gaussian. And then when they get turned into a density fluctuation, there's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of non-Gaussianity introduced. However, that assumption is very good. And it's been tested to about 0.1%. And we see nearly scale invariant fluctuations as well. But the important thing is to see the deviation from that as well, not just nearly scale invariant fluctuations. And we see a hint of a deviation from it. But we are still testing the basic aspects of this inflationary mechanism rather than specific implementation of it in terms of particle physics. In terms of scales, I know that there are all, in this whole week, there's been all these different scales, different energy scales, different physical scales. It's all very confusing. Let me introduce yet another way of looking at scales. So you can look at scales in terms of the scalar field rolling down a potential, right? So here's a cartoon potential, and there's the inflatone going down it. On very large scales, I put them on this side. We see the current horizon, right? And so inflation ends somewhere over here, yeah? So at smaller scales, for example, the solar system is here, right? So the CMB represents the largest physical scales we can observe today. LSS means large-scale structures, so galaxy surveys. They probe slightly smaller scales. So these are futuristic observations as well. So these are just starting to come into play. This is gravitational direct detection experiments. That's the only thing that will give us a hint about this scalar field potential at solar system scales, like LISA, for example, is not sensitive enough to do this, but something like that. So you're probing this small little bit of the potential with the CMB and large-scale structure at the moment. That's if the potential is real, of course. That's the big question. So as I mentioned, the inflaton is modeled as a scalar field evolving in a potential, but the problem is that many different potentials from many different physical motivations are consistent with the data. Okay? So that led a famous astrophysicist to say inflation consists of taking a few numbers we don't understand and replacing it with a function we don't understand. So what are we trying to do, both in terms of theory and in terms of observations, is to clarify the physics of the process. So we seem to see that there's this idea, this paradigm, that is very compatible with the data, but we're trying to figure out the physics of it. So for example, we want to understand, where did this function come from? Why is this potential so flat? The reason that's important is that you have to have sufficient inflation to solve all this flatness problem, horizon problem, and so on. And so that requires that inflation carries on happening till the universe expands by a factor of about 10 to the 30. And that requires a very flat potential. The other question is, you know, what are the initial conditions of this inflaton? And at the end of the day, how do we convert all the energy in the scalar field into the standard model particles and fields? That's also a very hard problem. So all of these things are going on. And what can these tensor modes add to this is that it's a smoking gun that will really convincingly tell us that this really was going on. Okay? It's not some process that just looks like this that we haven't thought of yet. So the temperature is only sensitive to the scalars, but polarization can differentiate between tensors and scalars. So the current limit on this tensor to scalar ratio is that it's less than about 0.2. And realistically, probably what's going to be observable is this thing greater than 10 to the minus 2. And if you measure this, it gives you two critical pieces of information. First of all, it fixes the energy scale of inflation. Like it tells you what is this V, essentially. And that translates into an energy scale. And it also tells you that there had to be super Planckian field variation, that is delta phi rolled more than a Planck mass, during inflation. Okay? Yes?
I just had a question that people who try to use particle physics,
yes,
supersymmetry or any kind of model to try to find the scalar field which could be inflation.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Supersymmetry, I don't think you can, but people have made lots of progress in implementing this in string theory. In the past 5 years.
But there are always problems. For instance, in supergravity, you have zeta problem. You have a lot of problems there. So in field theory, you mm-hmm. can't really do
it. Yeah, in field theory, you can't do it. But the progress that's been happening in string theory, I find extremely interesting. So in terms of rigor, what those guys are doing is much, much more, you know, rigorous than the simple field theory models that people make up. You can just write down a potential and make it predict a power spectrum that fits the data. But how to implement that into a consistent compactification is a really hard problem. And you know, they have made a lot of progress in doing that. And I don't think anybody's claiming that it's a final answer. So that's why we're trying to find observational handles on this.
Just a note, just because normally at the energy scales at where inflation took place, there should be a quantum field theory, not string theory, which should describe the thing. And the only quantum field theory that there is from string is supergravity.
No, that's not actually true. Because of this issue, inflation is sensitive to the Planck scales. It's not true that you can just describe it by... yeah, so it's sensitive to a series of operators, an infinite series of operators, that makes it actually sensitive to the Planck scale. So unless you have, you know, a completion, a UV completion of inflation, you can't really say that you've described it. So I don't think you could do it in effective field theory self-consistent, especially if there's tensor modes. Yeah. So it's a very hard technical problem, but it's also a very important, thing to understand about the universe. Where did all the structure come from? So I've got 5 minutes, so let me just skip through all this and give you an observational flavor of why this is a hard problem. The first one is, of course, the physics is hard. Ignore the plot because I didn't have time to explain it to you, but the issue is that we don't know the energy scale of inflation, and as I showed you, the energy scale translates very directly to the tensor to scalar ratio, this thing that was defined as the ratio of the power spectra, and that tensor contribution is very small. So here on this side we have a plot where it's just a plot of the sky in the CMB, and these little dashes represent polarization, right? On this side there's a huge tensor mode, on this side there isn't any. Can you see the difference in these little dashed lines? I would be extremely surprised. You can see the difference? No? Okay, good. That would be amazing. It's a very small signal. And in terms of the power spectra, you can see that this is the E mode, which we are just starting to measure in the polarization. And it's an order of magnitude down from the temperature, remember? Right? And this is another order of magnitude down. This is the maximal signal it could be. And this is probably the observational limit. So you can see it's a very, very small signal if it's there. The next problem is that the recondensing of photons on the way from the last scattering surface to us by large-scale structure converts the E mode into the B mode. And that produces an astrophysical signal that peaks at these large angles, but it also has some contribution here. And so that's something that you must subtract. The third issue is detectors. You can imagine if there's something about 5 orders of magnitude from where you can measure things now, you need much, much better detectors. But unfortunately, you run up against something that's called the photon noise limit. So you can't make detectors any better. So then you need to have a lot of detectors in one place in order to beat down this noise per single detector, right? So this is the photon noise limit. And so you need these detector arrays to beat down the noise. And we also need wide frequency coverage as well. So both of these things mean that the instrument that you build will be extremely heavy, right? But in order to get these kind of sensitivities and experimental control, you want to put things into space. And also, you want to look at large sky coverage because that's where this weak lensing signal is minimal, right? And you want systematic control. And so you want to go to space, but there are weight restrictions, right? This is extremely expensive. So you have to balance these two goals. The third thing, which I alluded to just now, is that we live in a galaxy, right? So this is a frequency, and this is the sensitivity of the antenna measuring the CMB. So the frequency is increasing this way, and you can see that this is a purported signal from inflation down here, but this is the foreground. And they dominate this signal at all scales. So this thing is frequency independent. So if you have a lot of frequency coverage here, you can subtract out the foreground signal. But it's an extremely difficult problem. And so these things make it very hard to do. So if you do all that, if you manage to do all that, and people are designing a satellite now called CMB Pole to try and do that, and they claim they can meet all of these issues, then if the signal is in this range, you would be able to measure it. And that would be a signal from about 10 to the 15 GeV to 10 to the 16 GeV. And that would not be accessible from any other means. So it's a way of probing physics at very high energy scales. So I think I'll stop there. Thanks for coming here this week and sharing these lectures with me.